The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Let's call this the Madness edition of the EMS Educast because it's March and it's just mad weather around the United States. This sudden surge of warmth, we're like weeks and weeks ahead, and plus basketball is going on, and there's all sorts of great stuff. So this is the Madness edition. And Rob, anything so exciting or maddening or madness-inducing in your world?
Well, the temperature is crazy here as well. I was just saying before the start of the show that they're forecasting 32 degrees tomorrow with a humidity of 36, which is about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's crazy. And coincidentally, two nights ago, I watched the movie 2012, so it's heightened my paranoia over climate change and everything else.
I'm sure I've mentioned it on the show before, but there's an amazing beer from the Stevens Point Brewery, my local brew, called the 2012 Black Ale or something. It's an amazing beer, and if it's the last one I ever drink, I'm okay with that.
So it has an expiry date of December 21st, 2012, is that?
I better stock up just in case they stop making it. I haven't even pondered that. Bill, anything making you mad or madness going on in your world?
Nah, nothing I can think of other than just like everyone else, the weather has been unseasonably warm. We've had, this is our second full day of rain, and that's not a bad thing. I think another day is due tomorrow and stuff. And then the weekend's supposed to be in the 70s and sunny and perfect in March, so go figure. It's Kansas. Wait 5 minutes. The weather will change.
Yeah, I'm looking at the national radar map right now, and everything over Kansas is just green.
So. Yeah, we got very little snow in West Canada this year, so the farmers are really worried about droughts.
Yeah, oof. Glad I'm not a farmer. I used to be in this business, and so much stress about the weather. I don't think I could be in a weather dependent. Just way too stressful.
I hear Arizona's opening up ski resorts now.
No. They've had cold.
I'm being facetious. Yeah, they had two feet of snowfall recently.
Yeah.
Like last week or something insane.
Yeah. So. Well, we could go on and on about the weather. It's probably a sign of our aging that we can do that. And we have a guest tonight, everybody, and we'd like to welcome Brian Lilly into the EMS Educast. Brian, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Thank you very much, Greg.
We're glad to have you. I think it was probably quite a while ago that you and I first connected and talked about having you on the show, and appreciate your patience getting in for an open slot. And you're the education manager at Taney County Ambulance District, or I like to say TCAD, but is that what the locals say?
Oh, absolutely. That's what we go by.
All right. So how about before you tell us exactly what it is that you do as the education manager, tell us how you got there. What were the sort of steps in the path of your EMS career?
Yeah, sure. Just so your listeners know, I have absolutely no claim to fame whatsoever other than recently surviving my first year as a training manager. And I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller on the Educast, and you guys have really been my bread and butter as to what are the best practices in EMS education. So I really got to thank you guys right off the top. Like I said, I'll probably be asking you guys just as many questions about EMS training as you'll be asking about my experiences. So thanks for that right off the top.
Well, we're glad to have you and glad you found useful nuggets of of gold among the many, many hours of sand we've probably poured in your ears. So how'd you get there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was at Kansas State University doing some undergraduate studies in kinesiology many years ago, and my roommate at the time was a non-traditional student who had just finished police academy, and he'd started working as a police officer, and he said to me one night, you know, I just don't think you're going to be happy as a track coach or a personal trainer or whatever it is that you want to go do with that kinesiology degree. I just don't think you're going to be happy. And man, I see what these guys do in EMS because we end up on a lot of the same scenes together. And I just think you'd dig it. So, you know, you want me to make a phone call? Maybe you can ride along with them. And that's where it started. I was just kind of lured into it. I rode once during my bachelor's degree studies at Kansas State, and I was hooked. So from there, I went to the Kansas City area and attended Johnson County Community College, where I do have a Bill Toon story. And and I got out of there in 2003. After that, went to work down in Branson, Missouri, where I'm still at.
Nice. So go ahead, Rob.
Oh, yeah. Are there a lot of kinesiology grads who end up in EMS in the U.S., in your estimation? I'm putting this question out to everyone.
Well, I certainly don't know for, you know, statistic purposes, but I think that the study of kinesiology lends itself very well to a paramedic education.
And the reason I ask is we do get a lot of kinesiology grads coming into our program, and I know the other programs around Ontario. It's a difficult undergrad program, very intense, in-depth, so kudos to you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
So you finished that degree, though, right, from Kansas State?
Yeah. Okay. It was a little bit interesting because I was in the process of applying to my associate's degree program for my paramedic studies as I was studying for my finals at my bachelor's degree program. But the interesting thing was that since I hadn't yet achieved my bachelor's degree, I had to go take the ACT again.
Whoa.
And that was pretty funny.
What's ACT?
I don't even know what it stands for, but it's a it's a college sort of placement exam.
Okay.
Some schools use it as part of their admissions criteria.
All right.
Yeah. That was interesting because I ended up scoring the exact same as I had as like a junior in high school years and years earlier.
You know, Rob's question, Rob, what I've seen more of, and fairly limited, and it's just Greg's anecdotal evidence, is people that were pursuing athletic training to be an athletic trainer and then had to take an EMT course or first responder course as part of their coursework and thought, well, why should I only occasionally get to care for people when I could do that all the time? And they sort of bleed out of athletic training and into EMS, or they do both.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. We get a lot of Centennial College, which is down the road from us. They almost 100% of their paramedic students are, well, I shouldn't say 100%, probably 70% are university grads. And they now have a university track where they finish their 2-year diploma and then they go on to the University of Toronto to finish their degree. But we see a remarkable number of kinesiology grads, phys ed grads, and then just general bachelor of arts grads. So yeah, it's interesting.
So Brian, when you went to the Johnson County Community College, were you able, because you already had a bachelor's degree, could you say, well, I just want to do the paramedic classes and get a certification, or did you also do an associate's degree instead of just getting the certification?
My general education credits transferred over.
Okay.
And my anatomy courses did as well.
All right.
So I was able to kind of go straight into that paramedic study. And the other thing was, as I completed my work at K-State on my bachelor's degree, I was also working part-time as an EMT for a small rural service. So I wasn't going straight into paramedicine, the zero to hero kind of thing. I had done about a year of part-time work in a rural EMS service as an EMT. So I had, you know, I had a little bit of experience under my belt, but, you know, the Kansas City area really, really took me by surprise, and I really had to, you know, step up my game. So it was a good experience.
I just had a little Skype anomaly there. Do I still have everybody?
I'm back. I'm not sure about Rob, though.
I'm here.
Okay.
Okay, good.
All right. Sorry about that. So did you, when you, so you'd already had a bachelor's degree, now did you, any broad sweeping generalizations about you and your classmates as far as like you already had some college under your belt? Did it help you? Do you think it affected you one way or the other?
Oh yeah, it absolutely affected me. I don't know that it necessarily gave me an advantage, though.
Right.
I was coming out of, you know, my 500, a couple of 600 level courses in respiratory physiology and cardiovascular physiology and biomechanics. And the interesting thing about a paramedic associate's degree is that you have one foot in the academic and one foot in the vocational.
Right.
And so when I was coming into my paramedic program, I was primed for all of the academic studies, but I ended up with 2 feet in the academic, and I was so hard pressed to get that other foot over into the vocational so I could really get my hands going as fast as my brain had been going. And
right.
I guess I probably lagged on the psychomotor side, because I was still so focused on the academic. It made the academic, I guess I was more engaged in it, but there were a lot of my classmates that excelled ahead of me because they were looking at it from the aspect of, you know, just tell me what works and I'll go and I'll do that. And I don't want to necessarily dive into the literature at this point, maybe later, but right now I just want to learn the skill. Huh. And so they probably advanced a little quicker in the skills because I was wanting to research and I was wanting to read the literature that supported the practice of that skill, and they were just wanting to learn the skill.
Rob, if you had students that have that kind of mix, like how does that challenge you as an educator if you've got...
I don't see a big difference between university grads coming into the program and students coming straight out of high school or students coming from the workforce. It just seems to be very individual dependent. Some are really academic focused. Some are skills focused, and it doesn't seem to matter what their background is, at least from what I've seen so far. But I do find some of the students who are very academically focused, they're fun to engage in the classroom. But, you know, sometimes I have to tell them that, when it comes to patient care, you have to do a little brain stapling technique and not overthink things. Great to sort of mull over your mind the risks versus benefit ratio of every intervention you're doing, and that's critically important. But at some point, you have to actually do something.
Right.
So,
I was advised of that many times, Rob, so I think you're right on the money.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it all sort of evens out in the end, right? And, and if it doesn't even out in the end, it evens out after a year or 2 years experience.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, Brian, was there a point that you recall where you got the balance that you were looking for? Was it a specific feedback or a call or an event that you had?
I think I'm still looking for that balance, Greg. I don't know. Nothing really comes to mind, but yeah. In my internships, I you know, I got exposed to a lot of different personalities, a lot of different approaches. And, you know, there were a lot of times where I just had to realize that my degree really helped me in a lot of ways. And there were some times where I just had to do like what Rob said, is just park all that knowledge for a while and recognize that you're completely ignorant of what it is that this person needs to show you, and you just need to stop and learn from them, and not be the theorist, and not be the researcher, and not be, you know, quite so heavy on the academics. Just park that and shut your mouth and learn.
Brian, did you find at times that your teachers were telling you things you knew were fundamentally wrong, that you had a more in-depth understanding of AMP and pathophysiology, and did you ever get that sense of, oh boy, I wish I could, you know, say something?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I did a little bit too often, probably, and you know, looking back on it, I look at it now. Just to tell you background about myself, I'm a dog lover, and so some of my analogies have to do with my dog. I'm pretty sure that my dog could whip a skunk, but that's not a fight I want him to get into, because ultimately it's going to be bad for both of us. My mentors there at the college often had to pull me aside and said, you know, regardless of whether or not you were right, you just have to stop engaging in these arguments. And, you know, so it's kind of like the, you know, maybe you could beat a skunk, but just, it's not a fight you want to get into. And I'll tell you, I don't want to paint with broad brush strokes, because those situations were very, very few. On the whole, I had some amazing preceptors, and I was really lucky because I learned a ton from them. It was, I think, probably only two times that I can think of over the course of a year that I had those kinds of interactions, but it was still two times too many for my for my faculty members.
It's interesting. I get some students with master's degrees who could, you know, run circles around me, and so I try to acknowledge that, and I've had to have similar conversations with students just about, you know, professionalism and appropriateness of, you know, when to argue something. But what I find interesting is that, and sad in many ways, is that once people graduate from paramedic programs and they're out in the field and they're working and they go through training, there still seems to be that hierarchy mentality that the person providing continuing medical education is the authority and the rest of their colleagues in the classroom are subordinates. And I find that really disturbing in my own practice as a paramedic, because you go to physician grand rounds and the physicians are very collegial. They're very respectful of one another, and they don't at all hesitate to challenge one another. So if a physician's up front talking about a procedure or something, the other docs have no trouble arguing against it, and there's no disrespect taken, and there's no feelings hurt. But in EMS, and I'd be interested to hear from you guys if you've had the same experience, whoever's designated as the educator for that continuing medical education day, you know, oftentimes takes great offense when someone in the audience says, you know, I disagree, or I would do it this way. And you know, that sort of classroom hierarchy mentality seems to translate into the field as well. Do you guys find that?
I think Brian and I maybe have had some similar academic experiences where I would have been better off keeping my lips sealed, and even back to grade school. But my transgressions in the classroom probably aren't the subject of this. I think what partly happens in EMS is many of us teach what we've been taught, and so you're your training as an educator is sort of like observational and experiential, and then sort of at some point the baton has passed and like, oh, it's now your turn to give this presentation or teach about this topic, and it's more just of a parroting back of what you've heard without investigation or, you know, sort of. So I think that's part of it.
I just wonder how we overcome that hurdle of, you know, the person in the front of the classroom is the sage on the stage, the boss, and everyone else had better just listen.
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think it is somewhat, I'm not sure if I could say the term cultural, but it may be in the United States a regional type thing, but it also may be how the education program that the people go through.
Yeah.
The program that I went through in when I was in New York City was very physician-based, so that was the model that was used. So we participated, the paramedic interns were treated just the same as the medical residents and the other interns and residents, and there was an expectation for us to answer questions, challenge, and I think that I remember that also equally went over to the paramedics, because they, where I worked, there was the people you wanted to have the greatest respect from were the people that sat in the seat next to you, and they had no problem saying, you know, I heard what you did the other day and you really messed up on that, what were you thinking? And they had no trouble doing that, and I think it pushed us and strived us to be good at what we do. Now, I can tell you that it didn't work here in the Midwest when I took my job here originally, and it led for a lot of sandpaper experiences I call. And I really do think it depends on the environment that you come in and how it's fostered and stuff. And I think the educator, if they choose to, can create the environment where they want their future colleagues to be that way and develop them.
Yeah, there's really a difference between the teaching hospital environment and the outer services, non-teaching hospital training areas, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, New York City has a plethora of teaching hospitals throughout it, so that was very much the environment. But when you left there and went to the community hospitals, it took on a much different tone and everything. So I agree with you.
So, Brian, you're an educator now, and I'm sure you must get some students with some fairly solid background or maybe some attitudes of, I know a lot. And
yeah,
how do you handle it now, having been on the other side?
Well, you know, the first thing that I do is just embrace the fact that there's probably well over half the class with more years in the field than I had before becoming an educator. And I'll freely admit that. And, you know, when we talk about stuff like the sage on the stage, and I've heard you guys talk so many times before about use of the Socratic method in the classroom. And the more I tried that, the better I got at fielding those tough questions and the potentially, you know, kind of adversarial things that would happen when one person tries to be that expert. And so I would take it completely in the other direction and say, you know, Greg over here has brought up a great point, and it's kind of different than what I was saying. You know, what do you guys think? I mean, Greg's here saying this, and this this curriculum that I looked into says that. I mean, how do you guys feel? And really dive into the, you know, collective 400 years of experience that is out there in the audience. And I was surprised how good a results I would get, because people want to engage. They want to become engaged in their education. I think there's already so much disengagement in EMS education, and so when somebody throws that out to them, I mean, I think a lot of students are happy to volley it right back and forth with you. So just that Socratic method and that group learning, you know, you guys have talked about it a lot. I'm here to say it works.
Yeah, and people really want to share their experiences. They want to be acknowledged for the experience they have. And it's so important to be sensitive to that. You know, so from Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, the need to feel respected and secure and free to express your opinion. How do you deal with the guy who's got 20 years experience, but in fact it's really more like 1 year experience repeated 20 times.
20 times over. Yeah.
And you know, he or she is still kind of fixated on some antiquated concepts, and they come up with something that just, you know, makes, how do you handle those?
You know, that's a good question, and I face that a lot. Probably still, I still do face it, and that's where I find you just have to be very well-versed in what the literature says, and you have to pull the egos out of it and say, you know what, I absolutely see what you're saying with your 20 years of experience. I haven't experienced that with my 10 years of experience. All I can tell you is what the Journal of American Medical Association said in this report, and there's a couple others here that we can look at, and really put it back on the evidence. And I've found that that really kind of shuts down a lot of that, to say, you know, I don't want to say that your experience over your 20-year career is invaluable. I think there is value to it. But for today, let's just talk about this evidence. Let's talk about this article. Let's talk about this skill, whatever it is that you're teaching.
Yeah. And get over the fact that mask trousers are not coming back. It's not going to happen.
Medicine's dynamic, Rob. Let's keep an open mind.
I still think it was a little premature to totally remove them.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just being facetious.
You know, Rob, your sort of point about like trying different methods, and Bill's point about culture, I think one of the things is you know, an instructor will say, okay, tonight we're going to try something new, and which instantly sends, you know, people sort of like, physically take one step backwards and mentally take three steps backwards. And then if the educator says something like, we're going to use the Socratic method, you know, then it's like three giant steps backwards that people are taking physically to escape this radical.
Just don't tell them you're going to do that.
Yeah, right. I never use that term.
Exactly.
So the presentation, but then you also have to make multiple attempts that you might be able to wear down the crowd with some persistence of, you know, get some acceptance of like, well, Rob or Brian or Greg, they're just going to keep doing this, so I might as well get involved. Or people might say, oh, this is interesting and it's working for me as a learner and a participant. And then the piece you added, Rob, of just reminding people that what they have to share is valuable and interesting, and their experience is good, but the conclusions that they might draw from their experience might not be supported by evidence. You know, it's just their individual experience. But what's the sort of collective experience, and what conclusions can we draw from that?
Yeah,
Greg. I find, go ahead, Rob.
Oh, I was just going to say, I find as being a student in a class, I find it frustrating sometimes that I can't disagree with the person up at the front in a collegial way, and I want them to disagree with me as well. You know, I want to have that kind of engagement, and so it's refreshing when you meet another educator who is open enough to say, to sort of hear you out and have the collegial debate about something. So, you know, I sometimes wonder if maybe I'm a bad student.
Well, that, you know, it's a real challenge, though, to be up at the front and then think like, you know, you got to sort of first in your mind think like, okay, is this about me? No, it's probably not about me. So then I got to listen to what they're saying, and I got to respond in a way that makes it not about them, but about the topic.
The topic, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, I would never want to embarrass or, you know, have an instructor up at the front lose face. I, you know, sometimes I just want to engage in a collegial discussion, and not many educators are receptive to that, but, yeah.
Well, sometimes those discussions are best held after the session offline or over a cup of coffee or whatever your favorite beverage is, and then you can. I like your term about saving face, and I think that sometimes we don't take that into consideration enough. I know that more than once I thought if I just spoke louder, I'd be making my point better, but sometimes the best thing is to just, you know, use that judgment to go the other way.
Walk softly and carry a big stick.
So, Brian, what led you to get into the role as the education manager? So you probably came down there as a field medic and then maybe into a supervisor job and then into education manager. What was sort of the flow of events?
Yeah, good question. Real quick before I jump into that, we're talking about saving faith and face and the Socratic method. Another educator taught me a really cool trick. When he goes around and does introductions at the beginning of every one of his classes, he asks everybody to state their name and how long they've been in emergency services. And he would keep a running tally of how many years.
Nice.
And then once introductions are done, he then introduces himself, and then he says, and you, as a class, have a collective X number of years. And so he doesn't call it Socratic method, but he's already opened the door to, hey, I'm going to be discussing with you because clearly we have this huge body of knowledge that we're going to take advantage of. So I thought it was a really cool trick. I've started using it, and students really like that you're validating their experience and you're going to add it in with everybody else's.
Right.
So your question, how the heck did I end up as a education guy? Well, I was actually just bouncing around in the back of the ambulance, happy street paramedic, and in August of 2010, we had our educator take a job in another part of the state, and I think really what happened is it left that opening, and everybody took one step back, and I was just kind of left where I was standing. So it wasn't necessarily that I stepped forward. It's just that I was the only one that didn't move or didn't run.
you were voluntold.
Voluntold, yeah. You know, I never saw myself as an educator. I had toyed with the idea of EMS management or EMS supervision at like the lieutenant or captain level, but it never quite came together for me. So I was just kind of happy to be the guy on the street, and I'll tell you, I love it. I still miss it on days when I hear the tones drop and the scanners going off, and you know, I still love getting out in the field. So I'd never really planned to be an educator. Like I said, about a year and a half ago, it just kind of appeared, and there it was.
Nice.
Yeah,
well, we're glad to have you.
What's that?
Are you still doing calls, Brian? Are you still out in the field?
Yeah, I try to take about I try to pick up at least two shifts a month, and sometimes I can do more, sometimes I don't get that much, but yeah, I'm still trying to get out there as much as I can amongst the crews, and every time I do, I'll learn something where I realize, man, I've let myself get out of touch, even if it's just for maybe 2 weeks. If I don't get on the ambulance for 2 weeks, I start to feel myself getting disconnected, and I have to get back on the truck, and then I kind of realign myself with the thinking of my paramedic colleagues so that I don't get too entrenched in, you know, the ivory towers of EMS education. Because, you know, you
such
can
as they are.
Yeah, I mean, you can really kind of just dive into all the stuff that's going on in EMS education and completely kind of separate yourself from what your friends on the street are facing on an hour-to-hour basis. And it's easy to do. I find myself doing it from time to time. I find it to be very grounding to just get back on the truck, realign my perspective, and makes it a lot better.
How many? I'm going to throw this question out. I don't know if any of you know the answer, but how many full-time college educators or people working full-time as educators in some sort of educational institution do you think, or what percentage do you think are still actively working on the road? Is that an issue? Is it difficult to stay on the road when you're a full-time educator in a community college or educational institute as opposed to within a service?
Bill, do you want to take a stab at that?
No, Rob, I admire your ability to do what you do by the fact that you have a 9-month or 10-month position, I forget what it is, and then you spend the other couple of months, practicing in the field. And I clearly think there's absolute value to that, and I know that I don't do it enough. I'm challenged because my work I find it so mentally exhausting Monday through Friday that I don't want to do more of it. I want to find, that's when I want to read my novels and learn about history and stuff. But I would have to say globally, I think it's difficult, particularly in the community college environment with all of the demands that are put on them to sit on committees on top of the intensity of the paramedic training program. I don't know many in this area that do it. When I was younger, I was able to teach full time and then we work on the weekends. But that was, 20 years ago. Now I don't have an interest to do that, but there is great value to it.
I'm just curious because in Ontario in the last few years, it's the operational demands of paramedic services that have made it really difficult for full-time educators to continue to remain current because they're asking for more and more hours of their part-time staff. And Ontario's a fairly small province. We have about maybe 8,000 paramedics, all levels, in the province. And I would say maybe I can probably count on 1.5 hands how many full-time educators are still on the road. So it's kind of depressing because people, you always hear people say, well, if you're teaching, you should be on the road as well. But it's getting more and more difficult here anyway, just purely from an operational perspective. So I just wondered if some states had the same issues. Not so much. I mean, anyone working Monday to Friday, it's tough to get out and do shifts on the weekends as well. But from us, it's more of an operational issue than a lack of energy at the end of the week.
Yeah. I personally haven't figured out a way to do it, kind of like Bill. And the full-time, like, community college educators that I know that also still work weekends or summers on the ambulance, I have no idea how they managed to pull that off of teaching full time and then running 24 hours over a weekend. Yeah. And how you do it, Rob, I don't understand.
You start to look like a crystal meth addict after you're 40 and you look like you're 80.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, the sort of fallback that I've had, and say somebody like rises through the ranks really quickly to become a supervisor or to have a position in the education department, and it will only, like, their limited field experience or limited ongoing field experience will only matter if they're not a really good supervisor, or they're not a really good educator. So if you're a really great educator and you're meeting people's needs for the educator, I don't think they're going to care if you're running twice a month or never or twice a week. If you're not cutting it, though, as an educator, one of the things that people will point to as well, they don't have enough field experience or they're not out doing this, and that's why they're bad. And running more calls isn't going to make you a better educator. There's a lot of other things to get to be a better educator that you probably have to do first.
Yeah, and Brian, I think you hit the nail on the head when you described sort of your philosophy of education, where you're not the sage on the stage. You're helping the paramedics explore the topic. You're not the one necessarily disseminating information to them. They're in an exploration mode, and I think if you had a year experience or 2 years experience or 20 years experience, it like you said, Greg, it wouldn't matter because the participants are doing the work, and that's a sign of a really good educator. And from a supervisor standpoint, I think when a supervisor realizes their role is largely support, that their role isn't to be the boss and to chastise and intimidate, their role is to support the people who are in the front lines doing the work, then those are, you know, the ones who do well in that role and get the most respect.
That's exactly right, Rob. I mean, what I try to get across to the students is, look, it's not going to be me out there in the field in this type of patient care situation that we're describing. It's going to be you guys or girls. It's going to be you folks that are out there. So, you know, use me and what research I can provide for you and what curriculums we can put together for you. And, you know, I really look at education as just as important in equipping a paramedic as the equipment we put on the ambulances. So, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with me. It has to do with, are they going to be ready for the next call? So I think when you approach it from that direction, you look at the needs assessment, and you say, where are the needs of our training program? And where are the needs of our providers? What are they saying they need? Then you can just sit back and go, hey, I'm not going to try to concoct this idea that I know what this place needs. I'm going to listen to you guys and girls, and you're going to help me steer this. And, you know, I've found that it works fairly well. It kind of depends on the audience, but I've had some pretty good luck here and there with it. So just kind of keep on going with that.
Well,
that's excellent.
Brian, you said you might have some questions for us, so we better get to that because we're running short on time already. So was there any ideas that you wanted to throw out to us or questions you wanted to ask?
I think the biggest challenge that I've had with trying to steer the training ship, if you will, is really getting your needs assessments dialed in for your EMS service. You know, I listened to a lot of, you've had a lot of great guests on that talk about field training officers and how you do that field training, like Bruce Napon and Heather Davis. And one of the things that I did was decide, you know, where is each program? For instance, where is my mass casualty training right now? Where is my pediatric training right now? And do a needs assessment, because that's really, I think, where it needs to start as a training manager, is just to do a report card. You know, where are we at? And then get that dialed in. And I've kind of come up with like a 4-level report card. And I'd be interested to hear, especially you, Bill, how you approach your training from a needs assessment perspective.
Well, I think it's a multifaceted approach, and because I think you've already probably learned that you have competing priorities that exist. You have your state requirements for your individual certification levels. What do they need to do to be able to continue to practice according to your legal entity that you're dealing with and within the state? You may then, on top of that, also have a competing local or county type thing. Some places, you know, have credentialing in addition to the state stuff. And then if you choose to support your practitioners that need to maintain their national certification, then that can be another priority. So those are just the regulatory things that can come into play, and you could have three of them that aren't in harmony and could work competing against you. Then on top of that, hopefully you have a way to tap into your quality management stuff, and you're able to look at time-critical diagnosis that become our real big one that we pay attention to. And we look at the time-critical diagnosis and measurements that we have, and then we try to figure out where the gaps are and then how we can develop an educational program for that. And then the medical director also comes into play, because the medical director is reviewing, in our system, reviews 3 to 5% of all of our calls, but they're very specifically targeted what calls that he looks at. And he picks up, through his experience, when he sees trends that he doesn't like, and he'll come to the education division and ask us to address something. We'll also end up getting something addressed from the operational people that will do the exact same thing to us, and they'll ask us to try to correct an issue. But usually theirs is a little bit more like a safety-related topic, something dealing with driving or cot safety or something, something with a little bit what they think is a more of an operational and not a straight clinical topic. So what you have to do is you have to juggle all of those, and then you have to figure out where the what I call the merit badges fit into it. And I really think as a if we'll use the term our career, some of us have gotten really hung up on the merit badges, and over time I found that I'm not absolutely convinced that they have great value, because often they become outdated in a very short period of time, and you're covering material that does not really meet the needs of your citizens. So it's not one thing, it's multifaceted, and you have to figure out how all of those things come into play, and then you have to build your plan to be able to cover those topics, and then there's only so much time in the day. And we're certainly running across that.
Looks like we might have cut off. I have a quick question for you, Brian, and
yeah.
Until we get Bill back.
I'm here. I just had to stop for a second because there was needed to I didn't want some outside noise coming in there. But I think you guys, Brian, if you come up with it, would you let me know?
Well, I have a 4-step process that for a new educator worked very well, or at least in my mind it did. What I did was I set my needs assessment at one of 4 levels, and it's absence, compliance, competence, and excellence. And the really great thing is that they all rhyme.
What's the absence part of it?
Well, so like if you're on a 0 to 10 scale, with 0 being absence of training, you know, maybe a service that just doesn't have, you know, enough educators, or doesn't have enough money, or whatever, limited resources, and they're not able to do, triage tag training. And they haven't done it in 3 years. Like, hands-on the triage tags, they're really, you know, ripping them and tearing them and counting them and, you know, all that stuff. That would be absence. It's just not there. It's a 0.
Right.
And then triage tagging that is done, you know, once every 2 years, like it's on a schedule. And at some place, you know, maybe it's your medical director, maybe it is a regulatory agency on the regional level says we want people to do it at least once every 2 years. That would be like a 2.5 or a 3 on that 10 scale, and that's compliance. And then the next step above that, you're basically doubling it. You get to a 5 on that 10 scale. That's competence. And in that triage analogy, that's where any day of the week, your providers have practiced with those triage tags enough that they can do it. They know where they're at on the truck. They can probably be a triage officer on any given day. They have competence. And that's that 5 on a 10 scale. But then to get to that next step, the excellence, that's that 10 on a 10 scale. And, you know, not many programs have that one thing that they do better than anybody else, because it takes a lot of resources to go from a 5 on a 10 scale all the way up to a 10 on a 10 scale. And I think that a lot of programs, at least the ones that I talk to, as I try to network with other training program managers, they're around the compliance level. And sometimes just meeting compliance is the majority of your work week. And there's a lot of areas where they're hitting competence, but you really spend a lot of time on just compliance level stuff.
And how do you identify system performance issues? Do you do chart audits, or do you have paper EPCRs or electronic EPCRs, or PCRs?
Yeah, we do electronic charting, and my supervisor, our clinical chief, does all of our QA, QI, and on a monthly basis, we analyze our key performance indicators, our KPIs, with our medical director. And so we're able to look at it as a clinical team to see if this ship is headed in the right direction with these KPIs. Are we doing better here, but maybe we're falling off over there? So I'm really happy with the way we've done it, because, you know, I've listened to Bill a lot, and I know, like Bill just explained, that's the way you do it. You've got to have your clinical data driving your clinical education. And, you know, I feel really blessed that we have that kind of setup where I'm at. I do know, though, that a lot of EMS agencies just kind of have to wing it and say, we're going to do merit badges because we just don't have enough hours in the day to have clinical staff that is devoted to nothing but key performance measurements of intubation rates and IV rates and drug administration rates and how many months has it been since you've touched a pediatric patient. And that takes a lot of staff hours.
And apparently now we're going to have to deal with the intubation skills retention issue, because intubation is good again. Did you guys see that new paper published by Henry Wang on PubMed, essentially saying that patients have a higher rate of survival if they're intubated and for out of hospital cardiac arrest compared with patients who receive a supraglottic airway? So there we go. We're going full circle again.
Now, I think you actually, and Dr. Wang would share with you, the devil's in the detail of that that study. And again, I think in a system where there's few paramedics doing a lot of the innovations, that's probably right. But what happens in the opposite, you know, like our system here, we have probably 250 paramedics, and we only have maybe one opportunity a day for an advanced airway.
Yeah.
So is doing it once or twice a year really competent? So I think that's a different thing. Brian, obviously, I see Daryl's had strong influence there with the key performance indicators, because I know he's really behind that.
You said the name. I was told I couldn't mention his name on the podcast.
You can't, but I can mention it all I want.
Yeah, that's what he said.
And there's nothing he can do about it to me.
I know. He said, don't bring up my name because Bill has too many stories on me.
And I won't reveal them because he's a good guy. So.
Yeah, he's great. I'm really happy to be able to work under somebody that has been in that clinical position and, you know, can bring that to the table. So, yeah, great person to work for.
You know, one of the clinical stuff of just how you have, you know, all this data and staff to pour through it. I mean, one of the things I think we got to challenge the PCR vendors is to help us filter it better, to automate the data searching process and filtering.
Yeah.
So it's less time consuming. So it's not literally somebody flipping through electronic pages or printed pages looking for stuff, but that we have software that can sort and find trends for us.
Yeah, and that exists too. That's just a matter of data abstraction where
right.
where the software runs through all the data and says, okay, nitroglycerin is given, and it looks at the blood pressure and the heart rate and the level of consciousness and says, yes, that was appropriate, or no, it's red flagged, and then it spits it out for someone to manually look at it. So
right.
that software definitely exists, and some agencies you know, hire their own programmers to do that sort of thing. What do you guys do, Bill?
Yeah, we do. We have exactly that. We have an electronic software that triggers the key events that we want to look at, like all trauma calls, all cardiac arrest, all calls where there's been three or more medications given. You know, there's a combination of things. And not only does the supervisor see those, but the medical director also sees those automatically and stuff. And then there's a couple of outliers that are in there, but we're able to do that, and we have an internal programmer that helps us do that.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
Gentlemen, we've got to start wrapping this show up. Maybe just a final thought or a comment, and then we'll end with you, Brian, before we close the show. So go
well,
ahead,
Brian,
Rob.
Ryan, I think you're pretty organized. I don't think we're able to give you any help at all tonight.
Oh no, you guys have helped a ton. You've been my bread and butter for the entire, you know, first year, my rookie year. You guys were all I listened to, so you helped a ton.
That's awesome. Thank you.
And Brian, thank you for taking the time to come here and speak with us tonight and share your first year experience. I'm sure other people that are going through a similar thing feel better that there's someone who's had a similar experience. So thank you.
My pleasure.
So, Rob and Bill, for first-year educators like Brian and colleagues, what's our fee for this advice we're providing? Because I imagine
it's
Brian
free.
Is just ready to sign the check and send it in, and we just need to know. It's free.
Yeah.
Well, if we meet up at a conference, I'll take a beer. That's all I need.
All right.
Just one.
Got it.
Ditto.
One really, really big beer.
I want to try that beer that you like, Greg.
Yeah, the 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and this is a good time to remind everybody that if you go to emseducast.com, you can find more than 130 episodes of great material. And I don't think much of what we've created is, like, out of date. You know, I think a lot of this is fairly timeless, so encourage people to sort through the archives. And if you find a gem, share it with your colleagues on Facebook, or if you have a blog, write about an episode that was interesting or helpful to you. Brian, do you have a final comment or question or thought that you want to share?
No, but I can give a little bit of a tip on some of these new educators and how to use podcasts and how to get some of these ideas in front of some of the people that may be influential in your agency, because what I experience and what I think a lot of new educators would experience is that they just don't quite have the street cred that some of the more veteran managers would have in their organization. And what I found was really useful is to go to these conferences, to go to these meetings across town, to take your iPod with you or whatever little device you have and plug it in and just play it on the vehicle radio for for however long it takes to get across town and play whatever podcast it is that's really got you thinking. And use these experts, you know, these Gregs and Robs and Bills that are out there, and just get it in front of your other managers. And that way you don't have to try to force the issue, and they can really hear it firsthand. So I've had great success just, you know, plugging it in on a drive across town and saying, hey, check this out. So it's worked great, and I'm glad you guys are there for it.
Well, we're happy to do it, and glad to have you, and hope you'll come back. There's a bunch of stuff that you and I had talked about that we might get to, and we didn't get to a bunch of things, so hopefully we'll be able to have you back again.
Absolutely, would love to.
We really appreciate it. Listeners, to wrap up the show, you might recall a few weeks ago or episodes ago, we talked about paramedics and should a paramedic earn a bachelor's degree either early or throughout their career. And that was also a conversation on the EMS Garage. And Dr. Dave Ross was part of that conversation. And he just wrote he's a columnist for EMS1.com. And he wrote an article that was published at EMS1.com this week. And we'll put the link to that in the show notes. But he shares his thoughts on that issue, and I think he lays out his side pretty well, and it's, I would say, a rather vigorous discussion last time I looked in the comments with that article. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes and encourage you to check that out and keep that conversation going.
I have to say I disagree with most of what he said.
Well, he did a good job of laying out his side of, you know, why he feels the way he does. And, but, yeah.
Another good podcast.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. So, thanks, everybody, and have a wonderful rest of March Madness. Thanks so much.